Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we recorded April 28th, 2021, Dr. Nora Ben-Sahel, Visiting Professor of Strategic Studies and Senior Fellow at the Merrill Center at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, offers us a bird's eye view on the past 5 years and the path forward for the United States' defense policy. This episode is part of a series on American security challenges funded by the United States Department of State. The goal of the program is to improve Canadian understanding of American policy perspectives in order to harness better communication and coordination between our two neighboring countries. The opinions, findings, and conclusions stated herein are those of the guest speaker and the moderator only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Department of State. This podcast is brought to you by Irving Shipbuilding, a strategic partner of the federal government's National Shipbuilding Strategy, providing skilled, well-paying jobs that support Canada's economic recovery. Focused on diversity and inclusion in employment and supply chain, Ships for Canada is growing opportunities for Indigenous people, women, African Canadians, and veterans. Because when we build in Canada, we invest in Canadians. So Nora, welcome, and thank you for joining us from the United States.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be with you today.
I'm going to ask you to offer your view of how the United States' approach to securing itself has evolved in the last 5 or 10 or 20 years. What are the broad trajectories of that defense security landscape, and how would you characterize them today?
Well, obviously, the 9/11 attacks on the United States really transformed the U.S. Comprehension of its own security. Really, the first time the United States has been directly attacked since Pearl Harbor. And as everybody knows, we've spent most of the past 20 years focusing on the war on terror, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then more recently with the rise of ISIS expanding to parts of Syria, parts of Africa, and elsewhere as well. We're at a real strategic inflection point, though, and I would have said this before President Biden took office in January, but I think it's even more true now with his new administration, where the United States is looking beyond those wars. And again, I would have said this even before the announcement last week that President Biden made that he's going to pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by this September 11th, a date which was chosen quite deliberately for its importance, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And so the United States is very much in transition, trying to refocus itself on an era of great power competition, particularly focusing on strategic competition with Russia and China, which is a very big pivot from where the UN's defense establishment has been focused for the past. And then, of course, the pandemic is focusing the United States to turn very much inward. And I think it's going to reshape how the American people conceive of their own national security. So I'm sure, you know, during our conversation, we'll have a chance to unpack all of these things. But it really is a time of a tremendous amount of transition. The United States, I think, knows where it wants to go strategically. Whether and how we're going to get there, I think, still remains an open question.
So you talked about an inflection point. From your vantage point, when would you attribute the start of that? Is it just the previous administration, or does it extend back historically? How long has this shift been underway?
I would say probably about the past 5 years or so, you know, predating the Trump administration, although obviously when President Trump came into office, he changed a tremendous amount of U.S. foreign and defense policy, perhaps not as much as many feared. There were still some elements of continuity, but obviously there were still some very major differences. But I think, you know, the war in Iraq had really ended for the United States by 2011. The United States didn't have a significant presence at all there, any presence really, between 2011 and 2014 to 2015, when ISIS reemerged and the situation was very destabilized in parts of Syria and northern Iraq. And I think that, you know, the emphasis around that time was on Afghanistan and getting Afghanistan right. But even, you know, 5, 6 years ago, it was clear that the peak of military operations, certainly in terms of the number of U.S. troops, had dropped quite dramatically. And a lot of defense watchers were looking around the world with a lot of concern about Chinese aggressive behavior in the South China Sea and the increasing technological capabilities of the Chinese military. And then, of course, the Russian invasion and annexation of Crimea in 2014 really focused U.S. defense attention back on, you know, the real problems of great power competition and how the United States was going to think about potential conflict in Europe for the first time since the end of the Cold War.
So it's a theme that I'm going to ask you to come back to at the end in a little bit more detail. But I guess as a Canadian, for a larger Canadian audience sitting here, I'm curious about your thoughts about where amidst that shift, the United States views the relationship between itself and its both traditional allies and new security partners. So certainly under the Trump administration, there seemed to be a very different flavor about embrace of allies in a very different context than we were certainly used to. How do you see the United States viewing its relationship with the other partners and allies in the West going forward?
Well, I think that is something that has changed quite dramatically with President Biden taking office this past year. As someone who's been a long-term NATO watcher, you know, from my earliest days in my career and then in the early 90s, I was afraid, and a lot of other NATO watchers were afraid, that what President Trump would do to the NATO relationship would be permanently and irrevocably damaging, given the way he talked about NATO on the campaign trail. I think that there has been a lot of damage done to the U.S. relationship with the alliance and its strongest allies, but maybe less than many of us had feared at the beginning, because he had talked about things like withdrawing from NATO, you know, quite strongly on the campaign trail. That said, I think that there is a lot of room to rebuild, and particularly in terms of style, but also in terms of policies. And President Biden comes from a long tradition when he was in Congress, and certainly when he was the vice president in the Obama administration, of really cherishing international alliances, of putting collective security front and center, of understanding the values of those traditional defense relationships. You know, along with the, you know, trying to integrate the new members of the alliance. They're not so new anymore, but we still think of them as the newer members, and ensuring that their needs are met at a time when the security challenges from the East are increasing, and the Mediterranean has obviously been a source of incredible destabilization for, especially for NATO's southern members. I think of all the alliance relationships, Canada counts as the United States' most important one. It may be one of the quietest ones, but you know, that sense of solidarity and the two North American members of the alliance, I think Canada is incredibly important to American security, even though it doesn't make flashy headlines the way our relationships with Britain and France and Germany sometimes do. And I expect that to continue again under this administration, which is extremely internationalist in its orientation. You don't just see that in the president, but in you know, the people who have been appointed throughout the State Department and Defense Department so far.
You had just a moment ago mentioned rebuilding in terms of alliances, but you'd also referenced COVID, which we're all experiencing. The United States had one of the worst kind of experiences with some parts of COVID. Obviously, there's other elements of a quite sizable domestic agenda that President Biden has been working on already. I guess, how would you characterize from this point forward the United States' ability to think internationally while dealing with the various domestic issues and challenges that it's got right now? And how do you see that factoring into how much bandwidth or attention or resources there are to engage internationally?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, the answer to that is still unfolding. President Biden clearly came into office determined to address not just the immediate pandemic, which he has done by revitalizing productions of vaccine. The supply, we were just talking beforehand, has increased exponentially over the past couple of months in the United States. And even though a lot of this is differs based on local jurisdiction, the nation is generally at a point where within another couple of months, demand for the vaccine is going to be the problem, not supply. So, you know, that's a good place to be in terms of the pandemic. But the economic costs to the nation, President Biden has already announced billions and billions of dollars that he intends to put up to Congress to pass for spending on domestic infrastructure. And he's defining infrastructure quite broadly. It's not just traditional roads and bridges. It includes childcare. It includes healthcare expansion. On top of the $5 trillion that the United States has already invested in pandemic relief, you know, these packages, the infrastructure packages, is about another $1.7 billion. And then there's another set of domestic spending that he's proposing that would be, $1.7 trillion. And the, additional about $2 trillion that he's probably going to announce later in the summer. that's going to have a pretty heavy fight going through Congress. Republicans are, we're seeing some indications already that they are returning to fiscal conservatism as their opposition strategy to a Democratic administration and democratically held Congress. And so those domestic fights are what the Biden administration is going to have to prioritize. That said, I don't think that there's going to be much of an impact on his ability for his foreign policy team and his defense policy team to be doing the work of revitalizing alliances. We see in the defense budget proposal for next year, it's probably going to be about unchanged, which is a net slight decrease because of inflation, but you know, largely the same. One of the things that we may want to talk about, which is separate from, you know, the president and his administration, though, is how the pandemic is maybe affecting individual Americans and their views of national security, which I think are going to change in the coming months and particularly years. But I don't think the administration is going to have too much trouble, with the resources and people it puts towards its internationalist agenda. But it is not going to be where the Biden administration focuses, because there are some very, very big domestic battles to come.
We'll put a pin in the resource question. Canada just had a budget a week ago, and that's part of the thing that our institute focuses on quite closely. But to focus on that, the relationship with the American people, interested in your thoughts about how the relationship between the people, between journalists, between elected officials, between the bureaucracy in the United States. There's obviously in the last 4 or 5 years, there have been all kinds of conversations about populism, about respect or not for experts. Where do you think the state of play is today in terms of the relation, all those different relationships as it affects international security and defense?
Well, it affects domestic issues here in the United States just as much. And that is, this is a nation that is still very deeply divided over questions like that. Former President Trump still exerts a tremendous amount of power and influence over the conservative faction of the Republican Party. That's not really right. The old traditional labels don't apply. There's still a Trumpian faction on the what we would consider the extreme right that is very influential, that doesn't believe in experts, that doesn't believe, there are many Americans who don't believe that the vaccine is a real problem, that the pandemic is a real problem, refusing to get vaccinated, all sorts of doubts on scientific and expert consensus. That is, I think, first and foremost, going to be a problem for our domestic politics going forward, but it obviously does affect, the U.S. role in the world and where the United States is going to be able to exert some influence, again, being so domestically consumed with the after effects of the pandemic and President Biden's, especially his financial response to it, the spending packages that I mentioned. But I also think that the American public is going to start thinking of national security in a different way than Americans ever have before. Certainly not all Americans, but I think a lot of Americans are. I didn't look at the statistics this morning, but last time I looked at the statistics, the United States has lost more than 560,000 of its people to COVID. If you look at how many Americans have been killed in all battles since World War II started combined from 1941 to the present, it's only 405,000. So we're already well above, the level of casualties in every war we've been in, including World War II to the present. I think that Americans who are already seeing a lot of domestic problems and challenges, the trends that were well underway before the Trump administration, but were really highlighted during the administration, income inequality, unequal access to healthcare, all of those things. I think more and more Americans are going to look at the $750 billion that the United States spends every year on the Department of Defense, because the United States has always prioritized the Department of Defense to meet its national security, meaning, abroad, outside of US borders. I think more and more Americans are going to look at that and say, well, that $750 billion didn't protect me in the pandemic. Right? Where was the military? The military wasn't part of that. And there are good reasons why the military, should not be in the primary lead for a domestic, crisis like a pandemic, although the U.S. military has played an important supporting role in certain places under its mission of, under direction of civilian authorities to help them, particularly the U.S., the National Guard has done that in the states here. But I think a lot of Americans are going to say that $750 billion didn't protect me or my family from the pandemic, from getting this disease, from many families that have lost loved ones. And I think that the support for the defense budget, the US defense budget, and how the US traditionally defines its security is likely to change over the next couple of years as however we emerge into a new normal after this pandemic unfolds. And I think that's going to be a budgetary problem for the Department of Defense, but it also may be, along with these other accompaniments of the theme of domestic rebuilding, is going to really focus Americans more and more here at home. And that will have consequences for the ability of the United States to continue to be a global leader as well.
So as a transition to the resourcing question, I mean, what you're describing in terms of American public attitudes, do you have a sense that that's being internalized within the national security bureaucracy and by the politicians? And then, so you mentioned defense specifically in terms of the resourcing, and I guess my message from you that I'm hearing is basically that defense is going to sort of stay steady, maybe it'll lose a little bit to inflation, but stay on the kind of a continuous budgetary track. Do you see a rebalancing aside from defense between some of the other elements and arms of American statecraft to potentially reflect a different shift in attitude? So I know that Biden administration is re-engaging with the World Health Organization, but would you foresee a greater focus on those other elements of international engagement as a kind of a recontextualization of what fundamentally contributes to America's security going forward, at least on the part of the experts that run these things in government?
Yeah, I think the answer to that question is yes, but. So the Biden administration has just a couple of months ago, and in fact, not all of the details are out yet, but basically submitted its first budget proposal to Congress. That's always a little bit of not a great indication. Any first budget of an administration coming in largely reflects the preferences of the previous administration, just because of the amount of bureaucratic work that goes into crafting a budget. So it's very common, again, no matter whether it's a transition from Democrat to Republican or Republican to Democrat, the first budget of any new administration usually is not dramatically different than the course that the previous administration was on. And I think that's true for the proposed defense budget for fiscal 22. The U.S. government fiscal year begins on October 1st, so fiscal year 22 will begin in October, not that far away. I do think that there's a chance for a lot of restructuring in that budget for the following year. When we get to a year from now, the discussions about the fiscal 23 budget, I think, by that point, the administration will have a chance to have made its mark and will be making many more trade-offs. But look, even the current budget that's being discussed, the 22 budget, does have significant plus-ups, particularly for the State Department, for USAID, and for other of the non-military aspects of national security. However, the Department of Defense budget is so big that it will continue to dwarf those agencies. And so defense, even though I think those other civilian agencies are getting desperately needed new funds to plus up and to rebuild their capacity, which in many cases, particularly at the Department of State, were decimated during the Trump administration, not just because of the deprivation of financial resources, but because of people leaving the Foreign Service, leaving the State Department, disagreeing with US policy. And there's been a tremendous amount of turnover that will need to be regenerated and repopulated. So I think, the administration is clearly trying to reinvigorate the non-military aspects of U.S. Foreign policy writ large, but solely because of the resources it gets, the Department of Defense is still going to continue to dwarf those other agencies, and it's going to be reflected in the U.S. approach to its foreign and defense policy.
So from what you just said, is it your sense? I mean, there's lots of discussion about kind of the hangover of the forever wars. Do you see the current context as sort of an echo of the post-Vietnam period where the use of force was looked at as a different type of tool that there was greater reluctance to employ than there had been previously? Do you think the United States is at that type of an era where you're going to, as you're saying, still be making very, very sizable investments with a view to a great power competition? But do you see a fundamental evolution in kind of the way that the United States thinks it can or will use force?
I think the threshold for when the United States is going to be willing to use force around the world has gone up and is going to continue to go up. There is a tremendous sentiment in this country from people looking at the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, people who have no connection to the military, saying, what just happened in these wars. We didn't win, right? There's nothing like a conclusive victory. And, you know, the outcomes certainly in Iraq and now particularly in Afghanistan, you know, I think the historical judgment still awaits, but they will at best be described as stalemated and may likely be ultimately assessed as far worse than that. I think there is a great reluctance, even among those in the military. I'm hearing increased sentiment of people in the military saying, what business do we have going abroad to, you know, rebuild places like Iraq and Afghanistan? We shouldn't be doing that. Even from, you know, some members of the military who are otherwise very vested in those missions, right? The fact that a lot of those people, even though they've lost friends and family members in these wars, are still, you would think that sometimes that would make them double down on the value of those things. And that's not happening as much as you might think anymore. So I think the willingness to go to war, in particular abroad, is going down. That will have repercussions for where the United States deploys force in other types of conflicts as peacekeeping or peace enforcement or, you know, in other types of international operations. U.S. Special Operations Forces, however, are going to continue to be at war. They're the piece of the force that will continue to be at war. I don't like really love the phrase forever wars, but, you know, that the threats of Islamic extremism are not going away, and that will be the piece of the force that will very quietly and you know, without much fanfare, are going to be dealing with those types of threats around the world. But in its broadest, the national security establishment and the Pentagon are really now focusing on great power competition and the potential for conflict. Nobody thinks that's guaranteed, but if you're the Defense Department, you know, you get paid to think about the worst possible scenario. And so the department is really shifting to thinking about what a possible war with China or Russia would look like. That doesn't help you reduce your defense budget, because even though you may be conducting far fewer operations, or at least less visible operations, because as I said, special forces are going to continue to be engaged around the world. The technological investments that the United States needs to make in order to prepare for the possibility of those wars are enormous new investments in new types of capabilities. The advent of artificial intelligence, you know, the United States spends trillions of dollars invested in legacy systems, for example, manned aircraft. I know people in the Air Force who believe that the last Air Force pilot has already been born because of the shift to unmanned. And so the research experimentation, how do you divest from a legacy force and transition to, you know, really new technologies, that's going to be consuming the Department of Defense for many, many years to come. That switch is already underway. It is only starting in the budget. That's going to be the real focus of the Defense Department going forward, of course, unless there's some sort of international crisis or attack on the United States that would obviously then reorder U.S. priorities.
Even just staying within kind of the frame of a great power competition, there's increasing discussion about gray zone conflict and the use of non-traditional kinetic, I guess, outside of traditional nuclear deterrent type of arrangements, but other elements of statecraft kind of outside of the recent norm being employed by Russia and China in particular. Lots of investments in economic activity, which are viewed to be for nefarious purposes. How would you see the non-kinetic elements short of either a nuclear deterrent relationship or having just simply the kind of conventional force structures and positioning that you're talking about? Where does the non-kinetic gray zone type of element feature into the future international security thinking for the United States?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's something that I think we're still exploring the answer to. I mean, there is a piece of that the US military is very involved in. Special operations forces don't just do direct action of, you know, the kind of finding and killing terrorist suspects that we've seen. They also historically, certainly during the Cold War, did things, you know, under the rubric of unconventional warfare that were deliberately designed to address the kinds of things that today we would largely consider as things in the gray zone. But the fact is, the United States is not going to be particularly good at those things because most of those are in the non-military realm, right? You know, if you want to affect the course of a US election, I gave this example even before this, you know, became true. Are you going to do it through some sort of military means, or are you going to, you know, use Facebook and social media to spread disinformation? You know, I hate to get all political science-y and, you know, Clausewitz and strategy 101, but right, Clausewitz has the famous saying that war is politics by other means. You don't necessarily need war anymore to influence those politics. And that's a tremendous shift that I don't think, frankly, any Western democracy is really doing a particularly good job of thinking about. And we have particular problems here in the United States, you know, especially with doubting expertise. And we've seen, you know, how easy it is for misinformation and conspiracy theories to move and affect large portions of the US public. So I think that's going to be a continuing challenge. The military will have some role to play in that. So it will be doing, you know, if you think of warfare as a spectrum of types of conflict, you know, it will be preparing for a great power competition at the, you know, more higher intensity level of warfare, and it will still have gray zone responsibilities down here. And that's going to be very difficult to do, to be able to do both of those things quite well in an era of stagnant or reduced budgets, at a time when great power competition requires expensive investments, and the gray zone operations have many elements to it that have nothing to do with the military at all. It's a really big challenge ahead.
Looking forward, it seems that there's already been, from this vantage point, a pretty clear break in terms of the reassigning a significant value to traditional American international values, concern for human rights. How would you kind of characterize the overall balancing of the material security concerns with views about human rights, human security considerations? Should we look at the Trump era as being a total anomaly, or is that potentially reflective at least one of the American parties having different views than have been traditionally held by America in this respect going forward? So just ask for your thoughts about the balancing between the kind of the values-based elements of what the United States does with the hard security concerns.
Yeah, that's always been a tension in U.S. foreign policy since the beginning of the Republic, frankly, and you can see that wax and wane. I do think that certainly this administration is trying to re-emphasize the human elements of that, the values part of American foreign policy. But that's going to be increasingly difficult to do other than with diplomatic support. Which will be a change, right? That was not what the United States was focused on, obviously, in the Trump administration. So the renewed diplomatic attention to that, some of the extra resourcing for the not just the Defense Department, which does a lot of international cooperative activities, and particularly the State Department, you know, Treasury does a lot of work on international financial cooperation and so on. I do think those are getting strengthened. Where I think that tension will most be evident, though, is in choices of where the United States chooses to intervene abroad. And again, anywhere on that conflict spectrum, from, you know, even just, you know, peacekeeping, peace enforcement, all the way up to being willing to, you know, really address human rights violations with more material aspects of U.S. power. I think that, again, coming out of two decades of unsuccessful wars, with a pandemic here at home and an incredibly divided American society, that the willingness to put a lot of national resources into fixing problems abroad, even when they get to some of the, you know, most fundamental values of human rights, it's going to be a difficult sell for a president in this domestic climate. And I think we're going to see a lot less of that. Tremendous rhetorical support and diplomatic support and maybe some financial support, but even that is going to be constrained by the you know, huge expansion of domestic spending that President Biden is advocating that Republicans are likely to oppose, and we'll see where that all plays out. But I do think you're going to see a less active United States in those areas because of shifting priorities and just because of the constraints that exist right now.
So as Canadians and other allies look at this new administration, which is already, as you've touched on, been quite different in a lot of ways from the previous one. Big question, but how should Canadians and other close American allies think about how the United States will think about us? So what's fundamentally going to shape the United States' attitude towards its allies moving forward? Do we expect a full return to normal? Do we think that there's going to potentially be more, not necessarily full Trump administrations in terms of their attitudes and their approach to allies? Can we expect more constancy, or do we have to continue to watch the results of each election when you folks have them?
Well, obviously, I don't know what's going to happen in the election here 4 years from now, what, you know, will happen at the end of the Biden either administration or first term. And a lot will be determined by that. Obviously, I'm too scarred from the recent presidential battle to be able to put much mental energy into prognosticating about that yet. But I do think that what US allies and partners, in particular, our closest allies and partners need to know is the US is going to be focused at home. That, you know, is not going to be the America first focus of Trump, but it is still going to be focused at home. We have enormous problems here in this country. We had them before the pandemic. The pandemic has exacerbated all of them. And so I think US allies need to understand that the United States under President Biden will continue to be, you know, hold forth the principles of internationalism very strongly. We'll support diplomacy, we'll support engagement, we'll be looking to dialogue with allies and come up with collective solutions wherever possible. But the United States' ability to lead the international community the way that it had before the Trump administration, and certainly in the years and decades preceding that, I think is where the United States just isn't going to be as energetically invested in those leadership role because we have so much work to do here at home. I remember I was thinking about this in preparation for today in the late 2000s, early 2010s, I happened to be doing a lot of work in Europe on NATO issues. And I remember having conversation after conversation with folks from the European members of the alliance of basically saying, you need to take on more responsibility for your defense because the United States isn't going to be there in the future. You know, this isn't just rhetorical. There are going to be real constraints. And I kind of feel like, you know, where the United States is right now, that is going to be a practical issue for the United States, even if the America firstness of the Trump administration is absent for at least the next 3.5 years of US defense policy. The US is just, we have so much energy and work to do here at home in general, and then particularly as a result of the pandemic, that I think the international community is going to have to realize that the United States is not going to be in quite the same leadership role that it might have been expected before. In many ways, there's a parallel to the pandemic, right? There's no going back to normal after the pandemic. It's going to be a new normal, and we're going to figure out what that is. I'd make the direct comparison here. You know, the US is going to reemerge with some of those principles still intact, but it's going to be a new normal. It's not going to be exactly the way that it was before the Trump administration either.
Well, Nora, thank you very much for joining us today from the Washington Era. I very much appreciate your insight into this, which folks in Canada are watching with great interest.
Thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/support. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producer, Charlotte Duval-Antoine, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.